On a windswept plain in the northern regions of Atlantis, a huge teardrop-shaped rocket with graceful fins is poised on the launching pad. Gruad is in the control room making last-minute adjustments while Kajetsi and Wo Tupod argue with him. Gruad says, "The human race will survive. It will survive the better, purged of these Atlanteans, who are nothing but swine, nothing but robots, nothing but creatures who do not understand good and evil. Let them perish." His finger strikes a red button, and the rocket hurtles on its way to the sun. It will take several days to reach there, and meanwhile Grodd has gathered the Unbroken Circle on an airship, which takes them away from Atlantis, and into the huge mountains to the east, in a region that will one day be called Tibet. Gruad calculates that by the time the missile strikes the sun, they will have been landed and underground for 2 hours. The sun rides blinding yellow over the plains of Atlantis. It is a beautiful day on Zukong Gimorlad Siragosa, the sun shining down on its slender, graceful towers with spider-web bridges spiraling among them. Its parks, its temples, its museums, its fine public buildings and magnificent private palaces. Its handsome, richly furred people gracefully stride amidst the beauties of the first and the finest civilization man has ever produced. Families, lovers, friends and enemies, all unsuspecting what is about to happen, enjoy their private moments. A quintet plays the melodious Zinthron, Balatet, Mordon, Swaz, and Fendrar. Overall, however, the great eye on the side of Gruad's pyramid glares horrid and red. Suddenly, the sun's body rages. Coiled flames, balls of gas, roll out. The sun looks like a giant fiery arachnid or octopus. One great flame comes rolling toward the earth, burning red gas which turns yellow, then green, then blue, then white. There is nothing left of Zukong Gimorlad Siragosa, except the pyramid with its upper segment now resting on the base, the anti-gravity generators having been destroyed. The baleful eye looks out over an absolutely flat, burnt black plain. The ground shakes, great cracks open. The blackened area is a great circle, hundreds of miles in diameter, beyond which is a dark brown and still, desolate wasteland. Thousands of cracks appear in the brittle surface of the continent, the strength of whose rocks have been destroyed by the incredible heat of the solar flare. A tide of mud starts crawling over the empty plain. It leaves only the top of the pyramid, with the great eye showing. Water sweeps over the mud, at first sinking in and standing in pools, then rising higher so that only the tip of the pyramid sticks out of a great lake. Under the water, enormous parallel fissures open in the ground on either side of the blackened central circle. The midsection of the continent, including the pyramid, begins to sink. The pyramid falls into the depths of the ocean with cliffs rising on either side of it to the parts of Atlantis that still remain above the ocean. They will remain for many thousands of years more, and they will be the Atlantis remembered in the legends of men. But the true Atlantis, High Atlantis, is gone. Gruad stares into his crimson glowing viewplate, watching the destruction of Atlantis. The light changes color from red to gray, and the face of Gruad turns gray. It is a terrible face. It has aged 100 years in the last few minutes. Gruad may claim to be in the right, but deep down he knows that what he has done isn't nice. And yet deep down there is satisfaction, too, for Gruad, long tortured by unreasonable guilt, now has something he can really feel guilty about. He turns to the Unbroken Circle and proposes. Since it appears that the Earth will survive the cataclysm, he was not really sure that it would, that they plan for the future. Most of them, however, are still in shock. Wo Tupod, inconsolable, stabs himself to death, the first recorded time that a member of the human race has deliberately killed himself. Gruad calls upon his followers to destroy all remains of the Atlantean civilization, and then later, to build a perfect civilization when even the ruins of Atlantis have been forgotten. The great beasts that inhabited Europe, Asia, and North America die off as a result of the mutations and diseases caused by the solar flare. All relics of the Atlantean civilization are destroyed. The people who were Gruad's erstwhile countrymen are either killed or driven forth to wander the earth. Besides Gruad's Himalayan colony, there is one other remnant of the High Atlantean era, the Pyramid of the Eye, whose ceramic substance resisted solar flare, earthquake, tidal wave, and submersion in the depths of the ocean. Gruad explains that it is right that the eye should remain. It is the eye of God, the One, the scientific, technical eye of ordered knowledge that looks down on the universe, and by perceiving it, causes it to be. If an event is not witnessed, it does not happen. Therefore, for the universe to happen, there must be a witness. Among the primitive hunters and gatherers, a mutation has appeared that seems to be spreading rapidly. More and more people are being born without fur, and with hair in the same pattern as Gruad's. The hour of God's eye has caused mutations in every species. From the Himalayas, the rocket ships of the Unbroken Circle, painted red and white, swoop out in squadrons. They sweep across Europe and land on the brown islands where Atlantis used to be. There they land and raid a city of refugees from the Atlantean disaster. They kill many of the leaders and intellectuals and herd the rest aboard the ships, fly to the Americas and deposit the helpless people on a vast plain. Far below their route of passage lies the Pyramid of the Eye at the bottom of the Atlantic. The base of the pyramid is covered with silt, and the break where the upper part of the pyramid had floated on anti-gravity projectors is also covered. Still, the pyramid itself towers over the mud around it. Taller by 3 times than the Great Pyramid of Egypt, the building of which lies 27,000 years in the future. A vast shadow descends upon the pyramid. There is a suggestion in the darkness of the ocean bottom of giant tentacles, of sucker disks wide as the rims of volcanoes, of an eye as big as the sun looking at the eye on the pyramid. Something touches the pyramid, and enormous as it is, it moves slightly. Then the presence is gone. The pentagonal trap in which the people of Atlantis had heroically and brilliantly caught the dread ancient being Yog-Sothoth has been, amazingly, undamaged by the catastrophe. Being on the southern plain, which was relatively uninhabited, the pentagon of Yog-Sothoth becomes the center of a migration of people who survived the disaster. Emergency cities are set up. Those dying of radiation sickness are treated. A second Atlantis begins to take root. And then, from the Himalayas, the ships of the Unbroken Circle come swooping down on one of their raids. Lines of Atlantean men and women are marched to the walls of the Pentagon and there mowed down by laser fire. Then, explosive charges are placed amid the heaps of bodies and the masked, uniformed men of the Unbroken Circle withdraw. There is a series of explosions. Horrid yellow smoke goes coiling up. The gray stone walls crumble. There is a moment of stillness, balance, tension. Then, the piled-up boulders of one side of the wall fly apart as if thrust by the hand of a giant. An enormous claw print appears in the soft soil around the ruins of the Pentagon. The masked men of the Unbroken Circle race frantically for their ships and take off. The ships dart into the sky, stop suddenly, waver and plummet like stones to explosive crashes on the earth. The surviving refugees scream and scatter. Like a scythe going through wheat, death sweeps among them in great arcs as they run in massed mobs. Mouths open, in soundless screams they fall. Only a handful escapes. Over the scene a colossal reddish figure of indeterminate shape and number of limbs stands triumphant. In the Himalayas, Gruad in the Unbroken Circle watched the destruction of the Pentagon and the massacre of the Atlanteans. The Unbroken Circle cheers, but Gruad strangely weeps. "You think I hate walls," he says. "I love walls. I love any kind of wall. Anything that separates. Walls protect good people. Walls lock away the evil. There must always be walls, and the love of walls. And in the destruction of the great Pentagon that held Yog-Sothoth, I read the destruction of all that I stand for. Therefore, I am stricken with regret." At this, the face of Ivo, a young priest, takes on a reddish glow and a demoniac look. There is more than a hint of possession. "It is good to hear you say that," he says to Gruad. "No man yet has befriended me, though many have tried to use me. I have prepared a special place for your soul, O first of the men of the future." Gruad attempts to speak to Yog-Sothoth, but the possession has apparently passed, and the other members of the Unbroken Circle praise a new beverage that Ivo has prepared, made of the fermented juice of grapes. At dinner, later that day, Gruad tries the new beverage and praises it, saying, "This juice of grapes relaxes me and does not cause the disturbing visions and sounds that makes the herb the Atlanteans used to smoke so unpleasant for a man of conscience." Ivo gives him more to drink from a fresh jar, and Gruad takes it. Before drinking, he says, "Any culture that arises in the next 20,000 years or so is going to have the rot of Atlantis in it. Therefore, I decree a non-cultural time of 800 generations. After that, we may allow man free rein on his propensity for building civilizations. The culture he builds will be under our guidance, with our ideas implicit in its every aspect, with our control at every stage. 800 generations from now, the new human culture will be planted. It will follow the natural law. It will have the knowledge of good and evil, the light that comes from the sun that blasphemers say is only an apple. It is no apple, I tell you, though it is a fruit, even as this beverage of Ivo's that I now quaff is from a fruit. From the grape comes this drink, and from the sun comes the knowledge of good and evil, the separation of light and darkness over the whole earth. Not an apple, but the fruit of knowledge." Gruad drinks. He puts down his glass, clutches his throat, and staggers back. His other hand goes to his heart. He topples over and lies on his back, his eyes staring upward. Naturally, everyone accuses Ivo of poisoning Gruad, but Ivo calmly answers that it was Lilith Velkor who did it. He was doing research on the energies of the dead and had learned how to take them into him. But sometimes the energies of the dead could take control of him, so that he would be just a medium through which they act. He cries, "When you write this tragedy into the archives, you must say, not that Ivo the man did it, but Ivo Lilith, possessed by the evil spirit of a woman. The woman did tempt me, I tell you. I was helpless." The Unbroken Circle is persuaded, and agree that since Lilith Velkor and the crazy goddess she worshipped were responsible for Gruad's death, henceforward, women must be subordinate to men so such evils will not be repeated. They decide to build a tomb for Gruad and to inscribe upon it, "The First Illuminated One, Never Trust a Woman." They decide that since the Loaigor is loose, they will offer sacrifices to it, and the sacrifices will be pure young women who have never lain with a man. Ivo seems to be taking control of the group, and Gua Tuon protests this. To prove his dedication to the true and the good, Ivo declares he has had his penis amputated as a sacrifice to the all-seeing eye. He pulls open his robe. All look at his truncated crotch and immediately retch. Ivo goes on. "Furthermore, it is decreed by the eye and natural law that all male children who would be close to goodness and truth must imitate my sacrifice, at least to the extent of losing the foreskin or being cut enough to bleed." Kijetsi comes in at this point, and they plan a great funeral, agreeing that they will not burn Gruad, as was the Atlantean custom, signifying that one is dead forever, but will preserve his body, symbolizing the hope that he is not really dead, but will rise again. There follow several thousand years of warfare between the remnants of the Atlanteans and the inhabitants of Agarti, the stronghold of the scientists, who now call themselves variously the knowledgeable or the enlightened ones. The last remnants of the Atlantean culture are destroyed. Great cities were built, then destroyed by nuclear explosions. All the inhabitants of the city of Pios are killed in one night by the Eater of Souls. Chunks of the continent break off and sink into the sea. There are earthquakes and tidal waves. Finally, only outcroppings like the cone-shaped island of Fernando Poo rise alone from the sea where Atlantis had been. About 13,000 BC, a new culture is planted on a hillside near the headwaters of the Euphrates, and it starts to spread. A tribe of Cro-Magnons, magnificently tall, strong, large-headed people, is marched at gunpoint down from the snows of Europe to the fertile lands of the Middle East. They are taken to the site chosen for the first agricultural settlement and shown how to plant crops. For several years they do so while the Unbroken Circle's men guard them with flamethrowers. Their generations pass rapidly, and once the new way of life has taken hold, the Illuminated Ones leave them alone. The tribe divides into kings, priests, scribes, warriors, and farmers. A city surrounded by farms rises up. The kings and priests are soft, weak, and fat. The peasants are stunted and dulled by malnutrition. The warriors are big and strong, but brutal and unintelligent. The scribes are intelligent, but thin and bloodless. Now the city makes war on neighboring tribes of barbarians. Being well organized and technologically superior, the people of the city win. They enslave the barbarians and plant other cities nearby. Then a great tribe of barbarians comes down from the north and conquers the civilized people and burns their city. This is not the end of the new civilization, though. It only revitalizes it. Soon, the conquerors have learned to play the roles of kings, priests, and warriors, and now there is a kind of nation consisting of several cities with a large body of armed men who must be kept occupied. Marching robot-like in great square formations, they set out over the plain to find new peoples to conquer. The sun shines down on the civilization created by the Illuminati. And below the sea, the eye on the pyramid glares balefully upward. The end.
Lights flashed on suddenly. The screen rolled up into its receptacle with a snap. Blinded, Joe rubbed his eyes. He had a ferocious headache. He also had a ferocious need to urinate at once before his bladder exploded. He'd had an awful lot of drinks at the plastic martini party, then made love to that Chinese girl in the cab, then sat down to watch this movie without once taking time out to go to the bathroom. The pain in his groin was excruciating. He imagined it felt something like what Evo, that fellow in the movie, had experienced after he castrated himself.
"Where the hell is the John?"
said Joe loudly. There was no one in the room. While he was absorbed in the movie, they, doubtless having seen it before, had crept away softly, leaving him alone to watch the death of Atlantis.
"Christ's sake,"
he muttered.
"Gotta take a leak. If I don't find the bathroom right away, I'll pee in my pants."
Then he noticed a waste paper can under the table. It was walnut with a metal lining. He bent over and picked it up, sending new tremors of anguish through a body on the verge of bursting. He decided to use it as a receptacle, set it down again, unzipped his fly, took out his dick, and let go into the can. What if they all come trooping back into the room now, he thought. Well, he would be embarrassed, but what the hell? It was their fault for springing this movie on him without giving him a chance to make himself comfortable. Joe looked somberly down into the foam.
"Piss on Atlantis,"
he muttered. Who the hell were those people he'd seen tonight? Simon and Padre and Big John had never told him about a group like this, nor had they ever said anything about Atlantis. But there was the clear implication, if this movie was to be believed, that the ancient illuminated seers of Bavaria might better be called the ancient illuminated seers of Atlantis, and that the word ancient meant a lot older than 1776. It was clearly time to leave this place. He could try searching the offices, but he doubted whether he'd find anything, and anyway, he was much too tired and hungover. Not only from the alcohol he'd drunk, but also from the strange drug the Oriental girl had given him before the movie. Still, it had been a very nice drug. It had been Joe's habit since 1969, when he wasn't too busy and didn't have to get up early in the morning, to get stoned and watch late movies on television. He found this so enjoyable a pastime that he'd lost two girlfriends to it. They'd both wanted to go to bed when he was just settling down in front of the tube, laughing himself silly at the incredibly clever witticisms, marveling at the profundity of the philosophical aphorisms tossed off by the characters, such as Johnny's line in Bitter Rice, "I work all week, and then on Sundays I watch other people ride the merry-go-round." What a world of pathos had been expressed in that simple summation of a man's life. Or appreciating, as one wordsmith does another, the complex subtlety of the commercials and the secret links between them and the movies into which they were inserted. Like the slogan, "You can take the Salem out of the country, but you can't take the country out of Salem," in the middle of The Wolfman. All of this capacity for appreciating movies had been raised to a new high with the drug Mao Sushi had given him, and added to this, it was a full-color movie on a large screen, uninterrupted by commercials, or, come to think of it, by Fanords. And even commercials, no matter how trickily interwoven with the plot of the movie, did tend to seem like interruptions, even to one who was stoned enough to know better. It had been a great movie, the best movie of his life. He would never forget it. Joe tried the knob of the boardroom door, and it opened at once. He stopped, considering whether he should take out his pocket knife and carve "Malik was here," or some obscenity into the beautiful wood of the table. That would, he felt in an obscure way, let them know that he knew where they were at. But it would be a shame to spoil the wood, and besides, he was dreadfully tired. He walked through darkened outer corridors, staggered down the stairs, and let himself out into the street. Looking toward the East River, he thought he could see light in the sky over Queens. Was the sun coming up? Had he been there that long? A cab cruised by with its light on. Joe hailed it. Sinking into the back seat as he gave the driver his home address, he noticed that the man's name on the hack license was Albert Feather.